and hello, Sun's House listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for a couple weeks, titled The Family Under the Bridge. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled The Magic Convention. And then it's The Nice Dream Truck instead of The Ice Cream Truck. The Bear and the Duck. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with The Littlest Weaver. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled The Magic Convention. One starry night, Amanda sat with her dog, Mr. Wu, and her parent, called Anna Lou, waiting for Uncle Bill to come again from the world where he was performing his tricks. Before you could say prestidigitator, which is the professional name for magician, Uncle Bill was in the door. He was holding a birdcage in one hand, and his other hand held on to boxes, suitcases, and paraphernalia. More boxes than you ever saw. "Do you know where I'm going?" asked Uncle Bill, whose favorite person on earth was Amanda. When she said no, he lifted her up in his arms and cried, "I'm off to a magician show, a convention for professional magicians." "Oh, could you take me with you?" asked Amanda. "I'll carry your top hat boxes and help you keep your magical things in order." "It's up to your parents," said Uncle Bill. "Very well," said Amanda's mother and father, after Amanda had worked her own magic on them. And that snow-filled night, Amanda and her Uncle Bill set off for the convention. Amanda carrying boxes, an umbrella, and Uncle Bill holding his secret collection of wands. As they found themselves walking through the snowy streets of winter, Amanda said, "Uncle Bill, I've always wondered, how does one become a magician?" And Uncle Bill thought a bit and answered, "When you're still a child, you have to feel that you have magic in you. It's not anything you can be made to do. Ever since I was a child, I just knew." And Amanda smiled a secret smile because she knew she had magic in her too. Welcome one, welcome all, welcome, welcome, magicals, said the sign in the large hall. And Amanda looked at the audience, which was composed of strange costumed people wearing capes and turbans. And Amanda looked at the stage where all the magicians were going to perform. Suddenly, the red curtains parted and the show went on. The first magician was announced. His name was Alakazam. And he took out of his magical box a silver-tipped genuine wand and passed the wand over an egg. The egg burst and out came seven chickens, one by one. Taking chickens out of an egg is a wonderful trick, thought Amanda, as she sat in the audience, taking notes on everything in her own secret notebook. And then Alakazam said the right word, which no one heard, placing his wand over the egg, and the chickens disappeared. Everyone applauded while Amanda wrote in her notebook everything she had seen. Then came the next magician, Shahrzad. She snapped her fingers and a lemon tree appeared. She snapped her fingers again and there was a tree filled with melons. And a third time she snapped her fingers. The trees were filled with swans. And everyone applauded, and the trees of Chavarnese, especially Amanda, who had never seen a woman magician before. And she scribbled down a few words, melons, lemons, trees, to remember what she had seen. Then Amanda felt a chill running down her neck. Uncle Bill changed into his magician's costume and into his professional name of Billy Baba was about to be on. Then Billy Baba stepped out of a huge box of mirrors. He was wearing a mustache, a black cape, and holding a magical umbrella. He began opening the umbrella, but oh, something was wrong. Oh no, thought Amanda, afraid that the trick was not going well because the umbrella just kept still and refused to open. Oh no, said Amanda to herself as she sat in the audience praying that nothing disastrous was going to happen. But Billy Baba only laughed, and perhaps, who knows? It was all part of the show because the umbrella suddenly opened up and down came magical rain covering Uncle Bill until he was completely wet. Then he snapped the umbrella closed and it was as if the sun came out again. Billy Baba was wearing his cape, but it was so dry. It was as if the rain had never happened. After Billy Baba, the clapping was so long, Amanda wrote in her notebook, I don't think anyone has ever seen this umbrella trick performed. The last act was a magician called Perry the Magnificent. And Perry pulled a deck of cards, tossing them up and down so that they looked like magical stairs. Then Perry spoke to the audience and asked for an assistant to come up to the stage. And he looked into the audience and saw Amanda. He spoke to her, saying in a loud voice, Excuse me, miss, would you object to pulling out a card? Amanda rose from her seat and walked slowly to the stage. Her heart was beating inside her as loud as a clock. And when she stood in front of the audience, she heard it go tick-tock, tick-tock, and it wouldn't stop. She looked at Perry the Magnificent, who seemed even more magnificent close up, showing his shiny cards. And Amanda picked her card and showed it to the audience. And then Perry the Magnificent guessed which card it was. The Ace of Clubs. Now everyone began to applaud, and Amanda took a bow, mostly because Perry was bowing. And they both bowed together several times, while the magicians kept on applauding. Oh, thought Amanda, what a glorious time I am having. That night, when Amanda returned home with Uncle Bill, she told her parents about the convention, how magical it had been. And she told them, proudly, about her role picking a card and about the audience and how she bowed when she heard them applaud. And late that night, after Uncle Bill went back to the world where he would always be Billy Baba, the magician, Amanda sat with her secret notes, sorting them out, telling her secrets to Mr. Wu and also to Anna Lou, telling them how she planned on being a professional magician too. And as she lay awake, she tried to think up a perfect name that would suit her when she traveled one day, performing for the whole world her own magic. Nice Dream Truck. When bedtime is near and teeth are all brushed and the house is asleep and the noises are hushed, you might hear a tune. You might be in luck. You might get a visit from the Nice Dream truck. The truck is a wonder. It floats and it flies, steered by a girl with stars in her eyes, who's ready to help you get ready for bed by serving up dreams to dream in your head. The choices are endless. The toppings, worth trying. They're silly and funny and so satisfying. With dreams about treasure and dreams about winning, dreams about magic and pirouette spinning. Dreams about summer and dreams about snow. Dreams about puppies wherever you go. Sample some princess, try super speed. Or be the great hero who helps those in need. Dream about flying, dream about whales. Dream about dragons with jelly bean scales. Scoop up some moonbeams, try astronaut. Or the triple dip cone, that's called making the shot. Dream of narwhals who draw on the ice, or years where your birthday comes not once, but twice. And if you like dreams a tiny bit scary, dream of sea monsters, hefty and hairy. Sample some drummer, taste some guitar. Try standing ovation, or even rock star. There are dreams that are big and dreams that are small, and dreams where the kids are in charge of it all. Dreams that surprise and dreams that delight, and dreams so supreme you'll choose them each night. So pile your dish with scoops to the sky, or choose just the one you've been longing to try. There's all kinds of dreams for all kinds of kids. Try something new. You'll be glad that you did. So scoop out your choices. Make up your mind. Hold out your bowl and get ready to find a dish full of dreams that was scooped just for you by this magical pair who make dreams come true. Now hop into your bed and snuggle down deep. You've got your nice dream. Good night. Time to sleep. The Bear and the Duck. It was the end of winter, and the day had barely started. Duck blinked, smoothed his feathers, and stretched. He took a running start, ready to fly off. But his legs and wings got all tangled up, and he rolled head over heels until, crash, he landed beak first in a jumble of branches. The racket started Bear from his slumber. "What's going on?" he grumbled. "Is it spring already?" And he went back to sleep. But all around him, the world was starting to thaw out. Scowling and rather rumpled, Bear finally emerged from his den. Duck winced in pain, but bravely called out, "Come any closer, and I'll break your head." Bear chuckled and shrugged his shoulders. "Are you afraid that I'll bite you? I'm far too old, and I don't have many teeth left." "Then help me get out of here," Duck said, "or I'm going to pass out." Bear gently freed the bird and scooped him up with his big paws. "Nothing broken, just a few scratches. We'll make you better. First, let's find you some shelter," Bear said. "My den would be best." Bear placed Duck on his old bedding.
"Well, it's a bit messy, but it's comfortable. Stay here and don't move," he told Duck. "I've got some things to take care of."
After a good scratch, Bear smoothed down his scruffy coat of fur and disappeared. The first buds were bursting, and from the last patches of snow, the violet's perfume filled the air. Bear ate some and brought some back for Duck, who flinched when Bear placed the food in front of him. "Oh, I'm also thirsty," Duck whimpered. "Of course," Bear muttered, and went to find water. After a few days, Duck was finally well enough to leave the den. The two went for a walk, with Duck riding on Bear's back. And while Bear bathed, Duck splashed around, sometimes lying in the grass. Duck would puff up his chest and start a story. He would tell stories about escaping fearsome hunters and flying past mountains that stretched up to touch the moon. Bear would grunt, admiring Duck's stories, or listen with one ear as he dozed. Then one day it happened. "I feel really good," Duck said. "I think I can leave now." He raised his beak to the sky, where the other birds were waiting for him. "Thank you, Bear. I'll see you soon. Don't worry, I'll be back." And after a few stretches, Duck took off. With Duck gone, the days seemed empty. Bear missed his friend. He ate, even though he wasn't hungry. Then came the icy winds and the first snow. Just like every year before, Duck settled into his den.
"Oh, I may never see Duck again, but I guess that's life, as they say, when sad things happen."
And Bear fell asleep for the long winter. Bear woke up to the sound of a dove singing. It's spring. He stepped outside, scratched his stiff body, and decided to have a bath. "What a flea bag," he thought to himself. Bear ate some grass. Then, warmed by the first rays of sun, he lay down and closed his eyes. Like in a dream, a quack quack echoed in his head. That's when he heard a voice in his ear. "Come on, get up, old Bear. It's me. I'm back."
"Whoa, it's about time," Bear replied grumpily.
Duck stroked Bear's head. They sat side by side. "I have so many things to tell you," Duck began. "But no, you go first." The Littlest Weaver. Far from the sea, in the hills and hollers of Appalachia's great southern highlands, lived Laurel, the littlest weaver, and her pa. Together they wove story rugs filled with honeysuckle and summer sunshine. For Laurel, though small, had a gift for weaving, as if her mama's angel's hands guided her. On market days, Laurel and Pa loaded the cart with their creations and made the slow journey to town. One day, a newcomer struggled through the market as if his small pack weighed more than he did. Laurel recognized loss in his eyes. It reminded her of her own. He settled in the holler and rarely left his home, high in the hills. So Laurel and Pa puffed up the holler, struggled up the rickety staircase, and stepped onto the newcomer's stoop. Laurel rapped three times, tap, 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 waited, and rapped again. With a mutter, click, slide, the man emerged. "We make rugs," Pa started. "They tell happy stories," Laurel finished. The man harumphed. Laurel looked past him into the shadows. "Do you have a daughter I can play with?"
"I used to," he said as he closed the door.
Laurel and Pa stepped from the stoop, clomped down the rickety staircase, and trudged down the hill. Pa, he had a doll inside his house, but no one to play with it. Paul nodded. "The talk in town is he lost his family in the great storm and came here far from the sea." Day after day, they came back with sunshiny creations, but the man wanted none of them. He didn't repair his windows, or plant the garden, or catch fish on the quiet shoals of his creek. He misses them, Pa, like we do, Laurel said, kicking a pebble down the path. He's at the cloudy days part. He needs rain showers to get to the rainbows. Pa drew plan after plan, searching for the perfect design. But none of his drawings were right, until he had a little help. For many days, Laurel and Pa poured sadness into their weaving, like they poured molasses on their hotcakes, their tears mixing with the threads. And when Pa tended the sheep, Laurel went on her own errands. When at last the story rug was finished, Laurel and Pa knew it was just right. They rolled the rug and secured it with a piece of twine. They puffed up the holler, struggled up the rickety staircase, and stepped onto the newcomer's stoop. Laurel rapped three times, tap, 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 waited and rapped again. With a mutter, click, slide, the man emerged. To always remember, she said. The man released the twine, unfolding the rug before him. Oh, and there's the rug. And it's him and his wife and two, and they're both holding two children. Laurel hugged the sad man. He hugged her right back. Pa clasped the man's hand. They slipped from the stoop, eased down the winding staircase, and coasted down the hill. The next week, Laurel and Pa came to the town market. They didn't come alone. And the last picture shows Laurel sitting on the man's shoulders. Go show the world, a celebration of Indigenous heroes. There's a power in these lands, one that's been here many years, strong enough to make you stand and forget all of your fears. It started in the past with a blast of light and thunder. Ancient ones looked up and beheld the sky with wonder. Under starry nights west, Sacajawea led Lewis and Clark so America could spread. Plus, she healed them when they were almost dead. The men got the credit, but should she have instead? Before he made the big leagues or won Olympic gold, little Jim Thorpe ran all the time, I'm told. His twin died at boarding school, leaving Jim alone. All he knew to do was run, so ran the whole way home. Finally, his dad said, Jim, don't run away. No matter how far you run, brother's gone to stay. It might be tough now, but you will be something. Before you leave, my son, I wanna tell you one thing. You're a person who matters. Yes, it's true. Now go show the world what a person who matters can do. Sue LaFiche Picot pushed doors till they let her in. They may have called her too dark or even too feminine, but she kept working hard, even as they mocked her, till she earned a name that stuck. Now they call her Doctor. In a foster home, Beatrice's heart reigned free, wrote a book about her life, and called it April Rain Tree. You need to stand strong, be Pegahamambo, who fought for freedom abroad and right here at home. When you feel tired, Remember, T-Wa-Zee, clear. She walked a sad trail, but shed no tear. Carried sweat rocks the whole way, so culture could live. When they asked her why she did what she did, she simply said, "You are people who matter. Yes, it's true. Now go show the world what people who matter can do." These, a few of my heroes, maybe now your heroes too. Let's look ahead at our lives. Think of what we want to do. Maybe be a doctor or movie star. It might happen. Maybe we do both, like our friend Evan Adams. We're like John Harrington in space. No wait, Mars. We're like Carey Price standing tall against a charge. Like Wannick Horn Miller, hurt, but keep right on. Become captain of our country, our spirits too strong. Tescamus said, "Perfect your life. Make it serve the people." Crazy Horse lived free, his spirit like an eagle. Net No Qua was a woman, like most, a true warrior, strong and independent, fierce as any man before her. Remember, always do right. Try to be positive. If you ever do wrong, make it up and please forgive. All paths are open to you, the brave. You take a stand. Wherever you go, these words echo through the land. We are people who matter. Yes, it's true. Now, let's show the world what people who matter can do. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with Hosea Plays On. Hosea tucked his shiny brass saxophone in its velvet-lined case and glanced at the wakening sky. In a day like this, he thought, I could play forever. He smiled. Maybe, just maybe, he would earn enough today. He stepped outside. Nate, his neighbor, looked up from raking leaves with his dad. Morning, they called. Nate lifted the rake handle to his lips and pretended to play. Keep practicing, my man, Hosea said with a tip of his hat. Hosea waited for the number 25, then dropped in his coin for the bus. Ka-plink, plink, plink. The city scrolled past, each stop bringing him closer to the public market. Screech, whoa, screech! Hosea clomped down the steps and shuffled through brittle, dancing leaves. He stepped through the market's archway and shooed cooing pigeons that were scrounging for breakfast. Hosea made his way to his favorite playing spot near a coffee shop. Beneath gathering clouds, folks streamed into the market. Hosea settled in, opened his case, and pulled out his saxophone. He took a deep breath, then released a tune, long and low. Fingers fluttered, keys clicked, smoky notes lifted through the air, threading along to waiting ears. People slowed, then stopped to listen to the melody. Some folks sat on the ground. Some dropped money in Hosea's case. His eyes crinkled with joy, and he kept on. Between songs, a woman asked him how long he'd been playing. This old thing? Hosea asked. Not as long as my first love. The woman raised her eyebrows. Miss Clarinet, he winked and started a new riff. As the sun ducked behind darkening clouds, a little girl stepped forward. She began to sway. The crowd hushed. She dipped and twirled her toes, a sweeping whisper. When the song was over, the girl curtsied, then poised for their next duet. But a peppering rain scattered the crowd to a nearby pavilion. Hosea played on. Later, Hosea sifted through the money in his case. No maybes about it. He'd earned enough. He packed up and made his way toward the market's exit. With a stop to make before heading home, he boarded the number 39. The music shop's door squeaked his arrival. "Good afternoon, Hosea." Miss May waved him in. "What'll it be today?" "How about a nice trumpet to go?" "How many trumpet players does that band of yours need?" Miss May teased. "Always room for one more," answered Hosea. He chose one he thought was just right. Near home, Hosea stepped onto the sidewalk. He listened to the music of the day, the scratch of leaves, the whistle of wind, the groan of a nearby bridge as a truck passed over it. With one hand hidden behind his back, Hosea watched Nate march toward him. "How'd it go, Mr. Hosea?" "Like this." "Nate, put that phony horn away." Hosea pulled the trumpet case from behind his back. "Because now you have a real one to play." Nate's face lit up. "For me? Thank you." He clutched the case to his chest. "Will you teach me too?" "Well, depends," answered Hosea. "You ready to learn?" They settled on the stoop. Hosea lifted the shiny brass trumpet from its velvet-lined case and handed it to Nate. The boy drew in a breath, then released a tangled tune. Together, the two played on. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for a couple weeks, titled The Family Under the Bridge. Armand, an old man living on the streets of Paris, is happy with his carefree existence, begging and doing odd jobs to keep himself warm and fed. With a life of simple pleasures, what more could he need? Then one day, just before Christmas, Armand returns to his favorite spot beneath the bridge to find three cold and hungry children. Although he has no interest in children, Armand soon finds himself caring for the small family. It does not take Armand very long to realize that he must do whatever it takes to find them a real home. Okay, last week, Armand took the three homeless children to see Father Christmas. When Father Christmas asked what they wanted, they all answered a house, which Father Christmas replied was impossible. Armand made the three children sing and then passed around his barrette around to collect coins to pay for something to eat. After they paid for pancakes, they decided to sing again for money until a man with a monkey got angry at them for stealing his audience. The four of them then ran into the children's mother, who is very suspicious how they paid for the pancakes and chestnuts. And that's where I left off last week. The children's mom grew very suspicious. "Where did you get the pancake and the chestnuts?" she asked. Susie and Paul lowered their eyes. "We sang songs and people dropped money into Monsieur Armand's cap," said Evelyn. Madame Claquette flung the children's gift to the ground. She angrily advanced toward the hobo, who was stretched out on his canvas. "You've turned my children into beggars," she accused. "You've been using them for begging on the streets." Now, Madame Armand tried to quiet her. "When the grand singers at the opera get paid for their songs, is that begging? I'll give you your share." But Madame Colette was busy tearing down canvases and gathering up blankets. I don't want any of your ill-gotten money, she retorted. We are going to leave here, she cried to the children. I forbid you to have anything more to do with him. The children began to wail. Even Jojo howled dismally because he seemed to sense that there wouldn't be any more pancakes on the Rue de Rivoli. Armand proudly rose to his knobby shoes. No need, madam, he said as hauntingly as he had spoken to the floor walker. I'll leave myself and save you the trouble. I know when I'm not welcome. It took him very little time to pack his baby buggy. Don't go, cried Susie. Please, don't let him go, Mama. He's our grandpa, sobbed Evelyn. He's all we have but you, added Paul. But Armand thrust out his bearded chin. You just keep your old bridge, madam, he said. It'll be a long time until you find anything else. Goodbye, starlings. Then he bumped his buggy down the quay. He clattered it as noisily as he could, so it would drown out the sound of the children's laments and the dog's howling. Chapter 5. Armand scowled ferociously as he pushed his buggy along the river. He walked through another bridge tunnel. It was deep and inviting, and there were iron rings over which he could hang his things. But the Paris fireboats were moored along the quay. Comes a fire on the waterfront, and all of Paris will gather on my roof, he mumbled. So he plodded on to another bridge. He only stopped once to watch a man pull in his fishing line because he thought there was a big fish on the hook. But it was only a sodden shoe. Ah, that's the way our hopes go, monsieur, Armand sadly told the fisherman. Then he began jumping up and down with excitement. The mate to the one in my buggy, he cried. That's it. The fisherman yanked the old shoe off the hook and tossed it to Armand. Ooh la la, monsieur, said the hobo. But that just goes to show we should never give up hope. At last he found a bridge shelter that suited him. He spread his canvas as carefully as a family man, laying the rug in his new house. This isn't as cozy as the room that canary made for me, he admitted. Funny how those black lines on the concrete kept out the draft. And he didn't sleep well that night. He kept wondering about the children. Were they warm enough? Wouldn't they be lonely? He tried to pretend to himself that he was fretting about something else. It was my bridge, he said aloud. They had no right to put me off my own property. I had to go back and assert my rights. When he woke up next morning, he noticed that a light snow had fallen during the night. He sat up and rubbed his eyes as he looked out at the quay. Paris had turned white overnight. It was a beautiful sight for those who could stand in a warm room and look through a window. What would the children do now? They'd probably play in it and get their death of cold with no grown-up to look after them. I'll show them, growled Armand. I'm going right back there and tell them what's what. I'd like to see them try to put me off my own property again. So back he trudged his buggy, and the wheels left wet black lines in the snow. There was no sign of life around the fireboats. But as he neared the old bridge tunnel, two women in fur coats came walking down the quay. In alarm, Armand noticed that the trail they were leaving behind them ended at the canvas propped against the wall. He quickened his shuffling steps. As the two women passed, they turned their heads toward him. Poor wretched creature, exclaimed the woman in the black fur coat. Perhaps we could save him, said the woman in the brown fur coat. "Ah, go feed the pigeons," jeered Armand. His big footprints erased theirs in the melting snow. He pulled the canvas aside. The children were crying. "What's the matter?" asked Armand. "You still bawling because I left? You might have known I'd come back." Susie pulled Evelyn closer. "Two women were here talking to us," they sobbed. "They've gone to get somebody. They're going to take us away and put us someplace," said Paul, wiping his eyes. "And they say they're going to put Mama in jail," Susie wept. "Oh, please help us, Monsieur Armand. Please don't stay mad at Mama." Armand kept twisting his beret around on his gray head. Now the soup was spilled into the fire. He knew women like those two in the fur coats, always trying to make hobos go to work or wash their faces or read books. And now they were picking on children. Must have run out of hobos. It really wasn't his affair, but Morelli had been right. These little ones. He pulled his beret down tightly. That was it. Morelli. "Start packing your boots in your cart," he ordered. "We've got to get out of here fast. Women like those two don't give up easy when they have a mind to save poor wretches." He helped the children gather together the few pans and fold the blankets. He pulled down the canvas and covered the cart with it. "But where will we go?" asked Susie. "Mama won't know where we are," cried Paul. "We can't leave Mama. She's the most of our family." "I'll come back and tell your Mama where you are," said Armand. "I've got just the right nest for you." He had to help them get their market cart up the steps. Then, because Evelyn's feet were so cold, he sat her in his buggy on top of his possessions. He pushed her down the street and across the bridges. Susie and Paul followed, pushing the cart. "If I were a big man," said Paul, "I wouldn't let those women be so bossy." "Where are we going?" asked Susie, as they came to the Rue de Rivoli. "To get Father Christmas to help us?" Armand looked back. "You don't need Father Christmas to help you," he said. "You've got me. Besides, he's too bossy. It's only 4 days until Christmas." "Will you tell him we've left the bridge?" asked Susie anxiously, "just in case he does find a way to bring us a house." "Now, don't you worry," said Armand. "Leave everything to me." Instead of leading them down the Rue de Rivoli, he waited for the automobiles to stop. He motioned the children to come alongside him with their push cart. They crossed the street abreast, and just as they reached the curb, a taxicab splashed them with dirty slush. But they kept on, single file again. Ahead of them loomed a giant shed. It was as big as a railroad station and as black and noisy. "The halls," Armand called back to them. "That's the big central market where all the food comes into Paris." The children quickened their steps at the word food. "I'm hungry," said Paul. "Well, you needn't get hungry at the halls," replied the hobo. "They sell most of the stuff wholesale. But a fellow like me can sometimes waggle some food there. I'll try my luck." They saw that whole streets were covered by black sheds. Now they had to pick their way carefully. The sidewalks were cluttered with crates and baskets. The pavement was slimy with torn red, white, and blue papers. They kept bumping into things because they were so busy Googling at the sights. Boxes of fruit and vegetables made walls around them. They were long alleys with endless rows of beef, sheep, and hog carcasses hanging on hooks. Men went by carrying great baskets filled with hocks and pig's feet and calves' heads. A man was lifting an immense box. He wore an outlandish hat which made him look like a carnival figure. "Who is he?" asked Susie, pointing. "Why does he wear that funny hat?" "Well, he's one of the strong ones," answered Armand. "He's mighty proud of that hat because wearing it means he can carry 440 pounds at one time." "Can you?" asked Paul. Armand shuddered. "Ooh la la, I'll never know," he declared. They hurried past trucks, backed to the curb, and lines of desks where buyers and sellers did their business. As they came out into the street behind the halls, Armand met many old friends. Ragged men and women were picking through the old vegetables and fruit thrown into the gutter. "Hello, Charlotte," he waved to a bleary-eyed man with his clothing held together by safety pins. "Good morning, Marguerite," he greeted a woman dressed in men's clothes. "Found any diamonds in the trash cans?" Then he bumped into a six-wheeled metal cart pushed by a man with a tall hat and baggy pants. "Well, if it isn't Louis," he exclaimed, "making enough money to pay your rent in that mole tunnel off the place, Maubert?" Louis grinned toothlessly. "I can get you a job today," he offered. "They need more pushers. They always do." Armand started away. "I'm pushing," he said, "and you can see I've got my own pushers with me. So long." The children hated to leave the halls. They had enjoyed the noise and bustle. "And with all that food," said Susie, "wouldn't you think they could spare us just a little bit?" They pushed their carts past St. Eustache Church and into a street teeming with other carts. It was as if the great market had spilled into this street in streams of fish and meat stands along both curbs. Paul stopped to look in the window of a coffee shop where colorful stuffed birds of South America were poised on open bags of coffee beans. The asphalt pavement ended when the Rue de Montorgueil became the Rue de Petits Carreaux. Now they trampled over patterns of cobble so tiny that they looked like mosaic. Armand stopped them when they came to a building with three black Egyptian heads trimming its front. He pointed to a narrow, winding alleyway. "Part of the old Court of Miracles," he said. "In the early days of Paris, all the beggars gathered back in there for shelter, and nobody dared bother them." He led them into the ancient alley with its dingy shops. "Why did they call it the Court of Miracles?" asked Susie. "Because it was like miracles the way those fake beggars shed their crutches and bandages when they came back here at night," explained Armand. "Then they'd feast and make merry. Even had their own king they elected." The children looked disappointed to see the rear of a great garage and some more dark stores taking the place of the old court of the beggars. "I bet you'd be the king if they still lived here," said Paul. Armand sighed. "Ooh la la, those were the good old days," he said, as if he had lived in them himself and were remembering. They left the court with its rakish memories. They passed the doorways of dilapidated rooming houses. In each, they could dimly see a battered old stairway, barely wide enough for a child, curving up to dark halls above, or perhaps a magic tower room. Who knew? Looking up at high window across the street, they saw a queer old lady hanging out her washing on line stretched across the window. And her washing was six long red pairs of underpants and six long red gloves, as if she might have been the wife of Father Christmas. At last they came to an open corner, fenced in by wooden boards. Above it rose the crags of buildings, which were slowly being torn down floor by floor. Only the tall, jagged walls were left standing, like rocky mountain peaks. On some of them, one could trace the original rooms by the great squares of faded wallpaper. They could hear a clattering and banging behind the fences, as if the workmen were busy at their destruction. But when Armand guided them through an opening, the children's eyes opened wide. The sandy yard was filled with makeshift tents. Two rattle-trap automobiles were parked among them. Dark-skinned men gathered around a fire were beating on old pans with hammers. There were black-eyed women with gaudy skirts dragging over the wet sand. Children with half-wild fox faces stared at them. Then five dogs came bounding toward them, snarling and barking. Before they knew what had happened, Jojo sprang at the dogs. There was a flying, barking mass of fur and growls. Then a gypsy woman came running with a stick. She began beating the snarling dogs without playing favorites. They stopped fighting and howled in pain and fright. Armand grabbed Jojo and pulled him back. The gypsy woman dropped the stick and began talking to the dogs in a low, soft voice. They whined a little, then sniffed at Jojo in a friendly way, as if he had now been properly introduced. "Armand," cried Morelli, "welcome, old friend. You look as if you have come to stay for a while." She looked at the children. Paul and Susie were peeping fearfully around the tramp's back. "Welcome, little ones," she said. "You will not be lonely here. I will get you something to eat." She helped Evelyn down from the buggy. "We don't come empty-handed," said Armand. He began pulling things out of his buggy. First, a bunch of celery. Next, a couple of apples. Lastly, he proudly held up a dressed calf's head. He saw the little Kalits staring at the food as surprised as if he were a magician who had lifted it from a hat. "Don't know how that stuff dropped into my buggy," he said to them, "especially with Evelyn on top. I must have brushed against something in the halls." The gypsy children closed in on the little Kalits. The boys were coatless and wore patched pantaloons. The little girls were dressed in gaudy skirts that hung to the ground from under their torn coats. Their long black hair was cut in bangs over their beady eyes. But they thought the Kalits were the odd-looking ones. They fingered Evelyn's red hair. They felt Susie's dark, rough coat, then touched their own gay rags. "Your clothes look so sad," said a gypsy girl, "but you have happy hair." A gypsy man put down his hammer and greeted them as warmly as Morelli. "There's always room for one or 10 more in our camp," he said. "You can share the tent with Petro Armand. He is in bed there now. He doesn't like the cold, so he sleeps all winter." "Can the girls live in the van with us?" cried a gypsy girl about Susie's age. Her clothes were the brightest of all, and she wore golden rings in her ears. But her high shoes clomped like boots because they had no laces. "And you can live in our tent," a tall boy offered Paul. "It's near a bakery wall, so it's nice and warm." The gypsy girl took Susie by the hand. "My name's Tinka," she said. "What is yours?" "Tinka," repeated Susie. "What a beautiful name. I'm Susie Calquette. And this is my brother Paul, and my little sister Evelyn. We don't have a home anywhere." "I'll show you our home," Tinka offered. "I'll show Paul and Evelyn too." She led the Colettes through an alley of tents. In the far corner was Tinka's home. The red-headed Colettes gasped at sight of it. It was a tiny house with a domed roof and carved brown doors and shutters. Instead of sitting on the ground, it was perched on wheels. "A gypsy house on wheels," said Paul. "Now, that's the kind of home I'd like to have." "We can take our house anywhere we want," said Tinka proudly. "We just hook it to the back of Uncle Nicky's automobile." Susie's eyes began to burn like blue flames. She squeezed Paul's arm. "Father Christmas, little donkey, could bring us a home on wheels," she cried. "He could pull it." "Let's tell Monsieur Armand," said Paul. "Then he can tell Father Christmas what we've decided." Chapter 6. The children's desire for a house on wheels worried Armand. Now, wouldn't it take them to think up something like that? "You don't need to have Father Christmas bring you a home now," he said. "Tinka will let you live in that one with her, and Paul will be in a comfortable tent." "But we want our own house," said Susie, "a house for our own family to live in. Then we can take the wheels off so we can stay in one place." "No, let's leave the wheels on," cried Paul. "Let's keep moving to new places. I'd like to live like a gypsy." "But if you move all the time, you won't be able to go to school," Susie reminded him. Paul looked as if that was not worrying him. The inside of the house on wheels was as nice as the outside. A big feather bed filled the back of it. There were shelves running all along the walls, and brightly scrubbed copper pans hung over the tiny stove. Susie could see that the little house was the tidiest place in the gypsy camp. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there and encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, The Family Under the Bridge. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.